It's nice to be able to introduce some of David's colleagues at this end of the partnership, indeed in our partnership with the History Department as well, as I welcome three cunningly mic'd people to the stage, Martin Wiggins, Tara Hamling, and Erin Sullivan. If you come up, then people can admire you while I describe what you are as a sort of learning objects. Martin Wiggins, what does one say about Martin Wiggins? It's an extraordinary privilege to be able to introduce Martin Wiggins to you as one of my colleagues after years during which I've admired and frankly envied his work. He used to win loads and loads of prizes at Oxford, and he should have more. I'm sorry, I haven't got one on me at the moment, but gave it away earlier. And Martin is an absolute legend as a scholar and especially teacher of Renaissance drama and the Renaissance theatrical world. He's about to publish a major book on the representation of regime change in Elizabethan drama. And he's in the process of publishing a complete catalogue of all the plays that survive or that we know about between the years 1533 and 1642. And Martin is probably the only scholar who could complete that book even if he was shut out of the library. You know, he could do that stuff from memory, not because he was there, but though he is the only person on the current active list of the Shakespeare Institute who is here for the 40th party, but just because he studied it so intensely and in such wonderful detail. Fabulous scholarship and very much at the core of student experience of reading plays, studying all the plays that Shakespeare didn't write and other people did. Alongside him, we have Erin Sullivan, who is somebody who was educated here and at UCL, and somebody who also wins prizes. She won the International Society for Cultural History Essay Prize just this year. She's a specialist in the history of emotion, gave a brilliant Thursday seminar about melancholy and how it can really kill you, which is a lesson to us all. Tara has recently published a book, Designing the Godly Household. She's an art historian and a social historian. She, of course, has had prizes, the 2010 Leverhulme Prize for her work as an art historian. She does domesticity, and she's currently helping the next RSC production of Taming of the Shrew with their beds, because there's an awful lot of beds in it, apparently, which we look forward to. And Erin, to go back to David, Erin has been very much responsible for further developing the online distance learning, which Kath Alexander did so much to pioneer earlier on. And they're just going to interview each other about each other's brilliance, and about particularly about the MAs and the student culture and just the amazing things they do.
Say that we don't quite know how this is going to work, because we want to show some slides as well, so it's kind of choreographed in a way, but we will just kind of, I suppose, ask questions as they come along. But I guess it makes sense if I start, if you're both happy with that. Can you hear? I got the short straw with the strange microphone, so is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, I guess I wanted to talk about the one side of my research, which is material culture. And I also wanted to talk about a past fellow that can't be here today, Catherine Richardson, because I like to think that I'm building on Catherine's work and what she did to establish the Shakespeare Institute as a centre for the study of early modern material culture. So hopefully you will have noted her book that came out just last month. And Catherine and I have worked together, although Catherine's no longer present in the building, I feel like she's still very much present here anyway, and she certainly continues to inform my thinking and my research. We collaborated together when I first joined the Institute in 2007, the University and the Institute in 2007, with a conference, Everyday Objects, and I think there were some members of that conference here today. And that resulted in this book that came out in 2010. And Catherine and I have very different approaches to the study of material culture, and it's part of that very fruitful collaboration that the Institute promotes, really, to get dialogue going across disciplines. And I come at material culture from the perspective of an art historian, somebody that works very much with from objects out to text, whereas Catherine arrives at the subject from text through to objects. So we've continued this discussion that started with everyday objects, and it's resulted in a couple more projects. These things sort of spiral on. So the first thing I wanted just to mention to you is this project, which is going to unravel over the next couple of years. That's probably not the right way of putting it. Develop over the next couple of years. it's just starting. It's going to start in January, but we've been awarded the money from the AHRC for a networking grant to examine ways of seeing the English domestic interior. It's a mega project in a way. In some ways, it's just sort of fairly modest in that it's for workshops to get scholars together to talk about interiors, domestic interiors, and different approaches to material culture. But it actually involves 17 different individuals across different institutions and organisations, including the V&A, English Heritage, National Trust, and I'm very excited that we're also talking to cognitive scientists to try and understand perception and experience of interiors now, but hopefully that will also inform how we understand how interiors functioned in the past. So that's pretty much in its early stages, but I hope that that's going to lead to some interesting and perhaps quite experimental research collaboration. Also, of course, again, continuing the theme of partnership, the great partnership that we have with the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust enabled me to look at a joint project with the Museums Department working on their fantastic collection of 16th and 17th century objects. So hopefully you got the chance to see some of those objects up close and personal over lunch. And Peter Hewitt, who's the doctoral researcher working on that project, knows all about these objects. I'm still learning, but here are some of them. Some of them you will have seen, some of them you won't. Just to give a sense of just how rich this collection is. And the project is really trying to reconcile the new approaches that are developing across different disciplines for the study of material culture with a kind of museums object-based approach. So we're trying to look at developing methodologies that allow for all those different approaches, but that make sense as well as a way forward for the study of material culture. So I want to bring the study of material culture back to the objects, and that's certainly what Peter's managing to do with the wonderful access that he has to these objects, thanks to the SBT, as just those trenches that you would have seen over lunch, beautiful objects. And finally, just to say that as well as Peter, I have some other PhD students working on early modern domestic material culture, and they contribute regularly. They've established this blog hosted by the Finding Shakespeare website, which looks at, again, the objects in the SBT collection, thinking very much about what these objects say about Shakespeare and his works. So in a very short amount of text, they have to kind of get to grips with these problems that Peter's looking at on across the whole collection. So there's the URL for that, and please do check it out. So that was to round up what I wanted to say about research projects. So I think if I hand over to
you. Sure, I have a little bit to say about some of my work here. I'm Erin, like Michael said, and I was thinking about how I'd introduce myself, and the first thing I thought I would say is I'm the newest member, but then I realized that's not true at all, because although I was only appointed about a year ago, since I've been appointed, there was Ewan, and then David, and Michael. So in a sense, I'm kind of an old stalwart now. and in fact, I sort of am anyway, because like Michael said, I came here to study it, to do my MA. I came on a one-year grant from the US, thinking that I would kind of do a sort of finish off my studies with the thing I loved most, and then go back to the States and embark on some kind of career I hadn't really sorted out in my mind yet. But as has also been a theme of the day, I think I really got sort of captured by the Shakespeare Institute community and culture, by the different fellows who taught me here, including Catherine Richardson, who supervised my dissertation. And that set me off on the path of research, and I went to UCL. My research interests are very much in the kind of the meeting between medicine and religion in Shakespeare's time, specifically around the subject of the emotions. And so I went to UCL to work with people at the Wellcome Trust Center for the History of Medicine, but always retained connections here with the Institute. And I count myself extremely fortunate to be one of the people that and things and initiatives that Kate was able to kind of bring back during her time as director. Speaking of things that Kate brought back, I feel like it would be a shame today if we passed without saying that this over here is also something that Kate brought back. I wouldn't count myself necessarily in the same category as the Moorish ambassador. But I did come back and you know, immediately, kind of, it's always nice. I never felt like I left the Institute, but obviously I have come back to it in a different capacity. So just a couple words on the research that I do. That I think integrates in interesting ways with some of the things that other people are doing here. I work a lot on the history of emotion, and some people might be familiar with this image, maybe from the cover of a book called Reading the Passions in Early Modern England that was co-edited by Gail Kernpastor, Kathy Rowe, Mary Floyd Wilson. In fact, Gail Kernpastor, speaking of examiners of theses, examined my thesis. And I think a lot of my work in my mind kind of builds on some of that interest in the passions that started in the mid to late 1990s and has really grown in, I think, unexpected and interesting ways in the past decade. Certainly in the realm of the history of medicine, it's really taken off in the past since I started my work. I think the next slide actually is a slide from the Thursday seminar I gave a couple weeks ago, which is about, as Michael said, dying of sorrow, the cheery topic. So I've been interested in looking at things that come sort of from the realm of the history of medicine, like the London Bills of Mortality, which were death registers from the period. This one, they post-date Shakespeare, but not too much. And I've been interested in categories like, not like gangrene, which seems to be what has been highlighted. Sorry, I think it's in the shift. That should actually go two categories down over grief. although gangrene is very interesting. But also in these registers, I don't think it's in this one, but you also get things like fright in these registers. So those are some of the things, kinds of documents I've been working with alongside Paris registers, life writings, poetry from the period, and Shakespeare's plays. But it's also led me to work with a lot of really interesting people in London and also here. So, like I said, there's a lot of interest now from the history of medicine in the world of emotions. So I was at UCL, but I also, during my time at UCL, worked quite a lot with people at Queen Mary, University of London, where the first, at least as far as I know, kind of major UK-based, certainly the first Wellcome-funded-based Center for the History of Emotion was opened. And have worked with them on various workshops and conferences and publications. But I'm also looking to just kind of watching as this subject grows in different kinds of ways. There's a center in Umeå in Sweden, multiple centers in Germany. This is a conference that I was a part of at the University of Hull, and I'm helping co-ed a volume that's going to partially be proceedings from that, but also kind of bring in new work. And also working with major centers like the ARC Center of Excellence for the History of Emotion that's recently opened in Australia. So talking to people like Bob White and Peter Holbrook about the work they're doing there, the fact that the Australia and New Zealand Shakespeare Society conference next year is going to be around the theme of Shakespeare and emotion, thinking about events like that, and also future workshops that we might be able to do with places like that. And I think it's our hope to not just to go out, for me maybe to go out to them, but also as much as possible for people both working within Shakespeare studies, but also in other disciplinary modes to come here. And along that line, Tara and I have been talking about organizing an event on affect in an interdisciplinary context, which would build on some of the work that is part of CREMS, which is the Center for Reformation and Early Modern Studies that's based at the University of Birmingham. So again, I think the Institute is very much about kind of building on the strengths we have here, but also linking out to other major centers in Shakespeare studies, but also in related or allied fields. There's so much to ask you about the research that you've been doing. So I don't really know where to start, but I don't know. I suppose everyone knows that you've been working on the catalog. And I want maybe I don't know if you'd like to say something about that, about where it is now.
Well, perhaps I'd start by saying where it began.
Yes.
And then move on to where it is now. It was in the last years of the 20th century that Peter Holland said to me, you really must do something big. Don't care what it is, but it's got to be something big. Anything big has got lots of stories about where it comes from, and one of the stories is that I went away and thought, what do I like doing? I like reading plays. Okay, I shall create a project around reading plays. Perhaps it would be truer to say that I objected to the way in which, first of all, there was a sort of binary division in Renaissance drama studies, which is defined either by the word and, which I have quibbled about in print before, but also by the word contemporaries, the C word, which should be banished from discourse. The idea that, that there's Shakespeare and there is everything else. The more I thought about it, it wasn't so much that there was a simple binary division. It was more like a sort of mountain where everybody starts at the top. Shakespeare is up there in solitary magnificence, and you go down a bit, and then there are some of the other canonical plays, and you get further and further down until right at the bottom there are the unpublished and Latin plays that nobody knows about. And it seemed to me that this was presenting us with a very partial view of a somewhat complex phenomenon, a partial and distorted view. It's the only mountain where you start at the top and hardly anybody gets down to ground level. I wanted to turn the mountain into a plateau so that everything starts off even. And what I conceived was the idea of a catalogue. Well, originally it was going to be simply an electronic resource, a database, where you could look for any play and you could find the sum total of useful knowledge that we have about that play, except for the text, because we've already got full text databases. So I had to think through what we need to know. There was a lot of theoretical thinking in the very early stages about what we really need to know about a play. Do we need a complete list of the plants in the play? No, we can get that out of a full-text database. But that, I could go through it. Do you want me to go through it, Erin?
What are some of the kinds of...
Yes, so things like when was this play written, who wrote it, where was the text first published, or where is the manuscript, or how do we know that it existed? If we don't have a text, what were its titles? All of those things that enable you to fix the play into its historical and literary context. What goes on in the play? What happens in it fictionally? What's its story? What's the roles? What sort of world does it take place in? What's the geography of this world? What other characters are there who aren't actually on stage, or who aren't on stage as performed by actors? Think of Yorick. Yorick is a character in Hamlet, but he's not performed by an actor. Well, he might be performed by an ex-actor, I suppose. But then things like, what's it made of? What language is it in? This is a catalogue that covers drama by British authors in all languages: English, Scots, Latin, Greek, Welsh, Cornish, and every day I give thanks that the one play that was written in Hebrew is lost. What are its literary sources? What are its verbal sources? What's its form? How long is it? Does it have a prologue? What does the prologue do? Does it have a chorus? That sort of thing. If you were putting it on, what would you need to have? What are the props? What are the staging requirements? Does somebody have to be physically injured or beheaded on stage? What are the songs in it? What costumes are needed? Things that theatre practitioners would need. What's its history in the world? Its stage history. How much was spent on it, if we know? what's its history as a text? When was it printed? How did it proceed through? Because some plays had loads and loads of early editions, and some plays had one or none. So that was defining the structure of an entry. And I mocked up some of these, and I sent one with some trepidation to Stanley Wells. And he said to me, I hope it was in admiration rather than admonition, I'm not sure. You do realise that you will have virtually to edit every play in order to do this. Well, it was planned as a 10-year project, and it was intended to hit the end of September 2010, when the first volume would be delivered to OUP, and it was in fact delivered in August 2010. That's long-range planning. So where is it now, was your question.
Yes, I was also going to ask, some people will know this, roughly, but I think many won't. Roughly how many entries do you know, in terms of, because you're including extant plays
and lost plays,
and kind of also ceremonies or...
Well, not ceremonies that don't have any dramatic content, but forms. There are forms of drama that are not conventional drama, like a royal entry into London or Edinburgh prior to a coronation, where the monarch coronand rides in, and then suddenly somebody pops out and says, "I am good government, and I've got some advice for you." So those are included because they include personation. In order to do this, I had to define drama,
right?
Which was pretty tricky. How many are there? I don't have a definitive answer yet, but I can get it to between 2,700 and 2,800. Mm-hmm. And the first play is number one, is called The Play of Good Order. And I really love that the last one, in December 1642, is called The Change.
Well, I wonder, because we're also wanting to talk about the MA programs, and also this kind of taught MA culture and also the research student culture, and you both, you teach on virtually all the MAs and also oversee research students at the Institute, so I was wondering if you might say a bit about that.
What do you want me to say? It's lonely being a research student. Because it's you and your supervisor and your thesis. You might see your supervisor once a month. And one of the really good things about the Institute is what Catherine Richardson called the conversations on the stairs. The things that happen outside of the normal... academic structures in this building, because this is a building which is in the right place and which is occupied by a large number of people who are all interested in the same thing. Mm-hmm. It gives that kind of centripetal focus which enables research students and us to engage with each other on a day-to-day basis that isn't quite as formal as it might be in a normal academic department. So that's one of the great virtues of the Shakespeare Institute, its building and its culture. One of the things that I've tried to develop is to find a kind of formal forum for that in the research seminars, which all of our research students contribute to and participate in, so that partly so that they get somewhere to share their ideas with everybody in the research community, rather than just their mates whom they see in the common room, although that's very important. But also to give them practice in presenting papers in a friendly environment, so that when they go to an academic conference, which is not necessarily a friendly environment, they have done it a bit. So that's one of the things, but it's also the kind of imbrication of the academic, the intellectual, and the social. So one of the things that Michael alluded to is the play readings that we have on Thursday evenings, where we read each Thursday in term time a uh, a play written by somebody who doesn't have the initials WS, although we would, if anybody ever proposed it, make an exception for Wentworth Smith. And just getting people to hear, and this applies to, this is open to all members of the Institute, and it enables our students and us to hear these plays spoken aloud, not necessarily very well every time, to get used to the rhythms and sounds of the language and to get used to the idea of how the plays work in real time. And this is the 18th year of the play readings. They were started by Stanley Wells and me in January 1993. So it's a major legacy, I think. And a lot of people have gone away from the Institute knowing that bit more about the drama of this period more broadly in a painless way because of that brilliant idea that Stanley had.
Mm. Well, Tara, you talked a little bit about some of your PhD students, and you also convene the MA in
Shakespeare, Stratford-upon-Avon, and the Cultural History of Renaissance England, and it wins the prize for the longest title of any MA anywhere, I think. So Massacre, we call it. I'm not going to talk... I'm aware of the time, so I was going to say a little bit about it, but I think I'll just skip over that. Apart from to say that the MA Massacre, which was set up by Catherine Richardson and that I was fortunate enough to inherit when I came to the Institute, we all teach on that programme. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather use the time really to look to the future. And one of the things I'm thinking about as a convener of that programme, is to think about looking to the future and thinking about how we might develop this. So I've been talking with Erin about distance learning, and I think it's perhaps better that... Sorry, just scoot through this. I think it's probably better that I hand back to Erin and we talk about distance learning.
Oh, okay.
I'm just keeping an eye to
that. Yeah,
time.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking a bit because there's always been, I think, at least as long as I've been here, it doesn't count for the whole 60 years, but there has been, I think, for a long time, a long-standing, very international aspect to the Shakespeare Institute, which is certainly present in Massacre, in Shakespeare Studies, and also we have two other MAs, Shakespeare in Theatre and Shakespeare in Education, all of which have always had quite an international student base, and also increasingly a mixture of full-time and part-time modes of study. So Michael mentioned Catherine Alexander and the work that she did building up the MA Shakespeare in Theatre and Shakespeare in Education, which have been, I think, really influenced the kind of... It really builds on some of the discussions from this morning about this desire to integrate discussions that have to do with theater practice and have to do with maybe was called more traditional literary study or the literary study of dramatic texts or whatever you want to call it. And the MA Shakespeare in Theater, which came first, really tried to bring that all together. And we're going to turn over to Jack soon, who now convenes those MAs, who's going to show some of the work that she does on those. I just wanted to say really briefly that what we've been working on with those two MAs in particular is building on, they've always been very flexible MAs that people could study full-time, but also in a modular form. And that's been one of their big successes. And we'll probably, especially considering the changes in the sort of academic university climate now, will probably continue to be an important factor, at least in the next few years. So the university as a whole has really been looking towards other more flexible forms of teaching. And I had a background teaching for the Open University before I came here, which is something I've tried to bring to the work on distance learning. So here's one of our, very happily, the midpoint of the distance learning promotional video for the university is one of our students, Taya Buckley, who stayed on to do her PhD with Michael. And also, I just wanted to show you a little bit of what the interface looks like. I won't talk you through all of it, but just so, because I think people find it hard to understand how studying at a distance works or how it could ever be anything close to like studying in the classroom. Well, it's not the same, but we have found that students really appreciate the fact that they can do both depending on how their schedules work. But our students sign into something called WebCT that looks like this right here, a picture of our library, with information about the module they're taking, their tutor, their schedule, reading list, assessment. In some ways, it's very similar to what you would expect as an on-site student to get in the first week. And then as they're taking their module, they might go to, they'll go through the different seminars that have been set out. So I've got a few slides from one that I'm teaching right now called Shakespeare's Legacy. So they might go to the introductory page on the afterlife. And we've been very lucky, especially with the help of David, and also just the way that library services and special collections on campus are working. We've been very lucky in that we're able to draw on them to help us figure out how to solve problems, like how do you get the readings online in a legal fashion? Well, it works, and so they can go and look at some of their readings online, sometimes listen to audio podcasts. We've been podcasting the Thursday seminars, or watch videos that have been made in-house or elsewhere at the SBT, things like that. And the other thing that has really been a direct result of the renovations that happened in the building this summer is additional AV equipment that's really helped this process. So if we were in that room over there, we have a camera in there that allows us to record snippets of lectures very easily that for a student ends up looking something like this. So you see me in stop motion talking to students who are around the table, talking about Alfa Romeo's Giulietta car. We're just about to watch the commercial with Uma Thurman where she says, "I am Giulietta, I am such stuff as dreams are made of," and asking, what is Shakespeare doing there? So I think one of the things that we're still experimenting with is to see how it works for students who maybe go between different modes of study. Also, how, because the Institute is such a place of great community, how we can try to involve those students who might be studying in the United Arab Emirates or Jamaica, Hong Kong, United States, Canada, and we have students in all those places, how to bring them in while we also look out. And I think through things like the discussion forums and through podcasting and things like that, we're trying to get there, and I think we will. Okay. Do you want to add anything else? Or should we? I'm conscious that there might be actors at the door. Yeah. Okay, thank you.